The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Hello to you. I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his travel agent, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 84 of The Big Picture, the week beginning November 6. Coming up on today's show:
amazing pets, fantastic beats, and the Baulkham Hills African Ladies Troupe.
Not to be eclipsed by Marvel movies get a big time weird with Doctor Strange.
Hello, gentlemen. Welcome, Sam. How's things?
Good. Going well. How are you guys?
Well, all right. Welcome back, Mark Hadley.
Yeah. I have returned from, what was it? Gallivanting.
Gallivanting, I believe, was the professional term we used to describe what you were doing in the past few weeks.
You'll be happy to know that you're actually available in Israel.
And what the big picture is, massive in Israel.
I was busy listening with the other two people. It's a wonderful show.
Glad your gallivant in Israel went so well.
All right. Now we need to get to some news of what is coming up. And what you are watching this week?
What we're watching this week, Sam, at cinemas are two movies that we watched on The Big Picture last week. We reviewed both these movies. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com to check out the reviews of The Accountant, which is Ben Affleck's new movie. It was good you weren't here last week, Mark, because we were talking a lot about Ben Affleck. You're a massive fan of that guy. Not really.
How dare you blaspheme.
But what we were told last week by Russ Matthews is that The Accountant is the thinking person's action movie of the year. Also out this week at cinemas was Hacksaw Ridge, terrific movie about a Christian man living by his convictions in intense circumstances. Filmed in Australia, directed by Mel Gibson, top cast, also reviewed on last week's show. Bigpicturewebsite.com for that.
Now, Mark, a bit of politics on the small screen this week, I believe.
Absolutely. Well, it's the event we've all been waiting for, of course. USA Votes Election Night live on the ABC.
Finally.
Now, I'm going to say.
Thank you.
I know, this would seem like boring television in any other political race, but it's just been crazy watching Clinton and Trump go at each other over the last few months, so it'll be a certain degree of relief as we watch them tear down to the finish line. That's a program you can actually pick up Wednesday, November 9th at 10 a.m. on the ABC. Me, I'll be sitting there with my popcorn watching the whole show go down. And also, applications for Australian Survivor Season 2 have opened.
I'm going to enter this time.
This time
I'm really seriously thinking of doing it.
Wow.
I could see you on that, Sam.
I would love to do it.
And winning.
I love the level of commitment that comes from, I'm really seriously thinking of doing it. Okay, you see, you're going to need more commitment than that for this show, because basically the applications say, are you prepared to battle with strength and endurance and strategy in order to survive the most inhospitable conditions known to man? I believe they're another tropical island, so I'm not exactly sure how inhospitable it is. What they don't tell you, Sam, be prepared, is that you don't get a toothbrush, there are no toilets, and you might have to live on goji berries.
I'm prepared for that.
I'm not. I'm definitely not going to apply.
Well, applications open this week, so get yours in.
If I disappear for a while, you'll know where I am. On an island somewhere.
With no toothbrush.
Surviving the elements. Without a toothbrush. Now, Ben, you got some entertainment news for us.
I do. We're about to talk about Doctor Strange later in the show, Marvel's big new release. But here's more Marvel news, because a week can't go by without some new news coming from the Marvel Universe. For the first time in the world, apparently, Brisbane's Gallery of Modern Art, called GOMA, is running the world first Marvel exhibition from May next year. The exhibition will display items from Marvel Studios and private collections, including artwork, film props, costumes. More than 300 items will be on display, including Thor's hammer, Iron Man's armor, and Captain America's shield.
I've got Thor's hammer.
What?
Well, it's irresistible. I saw it in a toy shop. Who would not want their own Thor's hammer?
How did you lift it, Mark?
Because I am worthy.
Wow. Okay.
We laughed.
As everybody else who bought it from Kmart, I believe. Actually, in other entertainment news, and speaking of toy weapons, a camera woman says security guards forced her 2-year-old son to check in his toy lightsaber during a visit to Parliament House because they considered it a weapon.
Now, this is a true story?
I'd just like to point out that these people just don't get out enough.
This happened?
The family, who did not want their name to be published, was visiting Parliament House on Friday when they were told the battery-operated plastic lightsaber was not allowed through security. The mother says, "They told me it was a weapon, so he couldn't have it." Now, I don't know which is more disturbing, that the security of our nation hangs on people who cannot recognise a toy from something actual, i.e. it's a lightsaber, or the fact that it was a 3-year-old who was armed with it. So what exactly are we afraid of?
Hmm.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Something to go in his baby book, his mother said, and well too.
Absolutely. Well, later in the show, we're going to be rifling through the vault to look at the best creature features, a bit of a theme on the show today. And Ben's also going to share with us Hollywood's top five amazing pets.
But before
we get there, Mark, you've got a pet puzzle for us.
I do. For true or false this week, a Hollywood fact that centers on one of the biggest Hollywood creatures of all time, King Kong, who will be crashing back into the big screen in 2017, by the way, with the release of Kong Skull Island.
That's right.
I'm kind of looking forward to that just for the extravaganza value. Andy Serkis, okay, many people might know Andy Serkis, the motion capture actor who played Gollum in The Lord of the Rings, played the role of Kong in Peter Jackson's 2005 remake. That's probably about the only thing you want to remember about that film, but we'll go on. Anyway, how did he prepare for the role? So here's our true or false question. Actually, it's a bit of a multiple choice. A, Andy Serkis, did he prepare to play King Kong by living in a London zoo with four gorillas and forming a particular bond with one of the females called Zaire?
Okay.
A. B. By travelling to Rwanda and living in the Virunga volcanoes with the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund? Or C. By picking fights with silverbacks, both in captivity and the wild, to see how they would react?
I want all of those to be true.
Yeah, me too.
Can they all be true?
Especially well, you're going to find out after our review, our next one coming up, and what your kids are watching.
All right, well, let's get to it right now, because fans of DC Comics creations will be well aware that the superhero mayhem doesn't just confine itself to the big screen, and after Suicide Squad, maybe that's probably a good thing. We're all waiting for the next big release, but DC keeps world audiences well entertained with a range of heroic television shows aimed at a broad audience range, where Arrow and Gotham keep the adults entertained. The Flash targets primary and early high school fans, making the release of the second season the best choice for the Big Picture's What Your Kids Are Watching segment this week.
It just feels like every time I win, I still lose.
My mother used to say, the universe doesn't give without taking.
I'm going to give you the thing you want most, Barry. But it won't matter, because you'll never truly be happy. Trust me, I know you, and I'm always right. I still win.
Mark, this is the second season. Can you give us a summary in 30 words or less about what our kids are watching?
Okay, for people who haven't been following the whole Flash phenomena, Barry Allen, who's played by Grant Gustin. Look, I'm not going to do 30 words.
Let's I was counting. I think you've already smashed about 100.
Grant Gustin plays Barry Allen. He wakes up from a coma after being hit by lightning, discovers he's been given the power of super speed, runs out and starts saving the city from criminals. Okay, and that was only season one.
Okay. What can you possibly do in season two then?
In season one, he was basically saving the world from the Reverse Flash. Season two.
What's a Reverse Flash?
I'm sorry, we're past that series. We're moving on to season two.
Right.
In season two, he's saving the world from the Zoom, who's also a fast bad guy from Earth 2.
Don't laugh
at that.
They needed to think of another name. The Flash. The Zoom.
There you go. So now he's basically getting rid of other bad guys, but we've crashed into Earth 2 now through an interdimensional barrier, blah, blah, blah. Have fun.
This is in our What Your Kids Are Watching segment this week. Are your boys watching The Flash? Are they into it?
They are incredibly into it. We have to ration this program. And actually, our family's not alone. There are bunches of kids. I think you'll find that if you've got kids in a sort of late primary or mid-primary, early high school, particularly boys, they're going to love watching The Flash. It's one of those great sort of family events, good TV together type program, and at least for the boys. I feel like there's no bad language, there's limited adult themes, safe content. The worst thing you're going to see is a kiss, and there's even a cute moment associated with that at my household, because I've got a six-year-old who's still in that age where if somebody kisses, he throws himself bodily over the other side of the lounge. So I feel like there's plenty going on for the whole family there. If you don't like the show, you can just watch the antics of your kids.
Yeah, right. Well, it sounds like it's a lot of fun, this show, but are there lessons you can take away from watching it?
Yeah, there's a lot here. Barry is basically humble. He doesn't think too much of himself and much more of others. That's the goal. So he's more likely to end up losing personally to help someone else win. And that's the servant of others mantra that we should be familiar with as Christians. And that's the sort of thing I think you think about drip feed morality. I think that's something that parents should keep in mind.
What do you mean by that?
Drip feed morality is where basically things that we want, they're not powerful messages, but they're consistent messages. And if you want to put your children in front of programs, look out for drip feed morality. The sort of stuff that, you know, you might go, oh, there's no huge lesson there, but it's the sort of stuff I want affirmed again and again and again. And an episode of The Flash doesn't go by without us seeing Barry think about how somebody else has to come before himself.
Okay.
And I feel like that's the sort of thing I can safely put my kids in front of.
So you sit with the boys and watch The Flash. And is this just because you're a fan or because you want to encourage them to watch it? Well, what's going on in the Hadley household?
Happily, these two things coincide. So I'm a bit of a fan and the boys want to watch it. And for some reason, my wife always finds plenty of ironing to do around that time. So she's obviously, you know, keeping the household running while the rest of us are just basically vegging
out. This is getting quite the thumbs up for the second series.
It's a really... it's fun. It's pretty much, if you like the first series and your kids enjoyed that, they'll love the second. And it seems so far that the morality is just online for what a Christian would want their children to be watching.
Okay. The Flash stars Grant Gustin. Is that right? Grant Gustin?
Grant Gustin.
Jesse Martin, Candace Patton, and Tom Cavanagh. Names I've never heard of. But are they quite good in the show?
They are famous in the Flash universe.
They are. It's rated M for mature themes and violence. Oh, so a little bit of caution exercised around the age that your kids will be watching this.
The violence is kind of the level of thwack and pow.
Kapow!
Yeah.
All 23 episodes of season 2 are now streaming down the interwebs on Stan.
All right, time for our true or false answer, Mark Hadley.
So you were basically wondering, how did Andy Serkis actually prepare for playing the role of King Kong?
Mm.
Did he live in a London zoo and form a relationship with a female gorilla called Zaire?
Please
did
be that one.
Did he travel to Rwanda and live in the Virunga volcanoes?
I'm hoping C.
Oh, or did he pick fights with silverbacks, yeah, both in captivity and the wild, to see how they react? What are you going for?
My vote's going for A.
You're going for A, so you're basically saying Zaire. And
C, it's not going to be C, but I'm hoping it's C.
Gentlemen, let me make your day. It's all three.
Oh, yes!
Seriously, yeah, all three.
Awesome!
He basically did form a relationship with a female gorilla called Zaire. I believe they're very happy. he did live in the Virungan volcanoes for a certain period of time, and he did pick fights with silverbacks. Can you imagine picking a fight with a silverback in the wild?
We're not encouraging that, but that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great way of preparing for a role if you survive.
Only Gollum would do such a thing, I think.
Monkey business.
That's right. Coming up on The Big Picture, the Borkum Hills African Ladies Troupe and how they're using the stage and screen to help abused women find healing.
Welcome back.
Now, a new documentary has been recently released with a very intriguing title, The Borkum Hills African Ladies Troupe. Now, originally conceived as a stage production, the Ladies Troupe brought together four African women who all had experienced significant abuse and trauma in their lives. What they share on stage and also in this documentary is eye-opening and inspiring.
Wow, look at these women. They survive all this.
So we hear so many stories about girls being taken away, being kidnapped.
Everybody knows it's happening and nobody's doing anything.
These women are coming from war-torn countries.
I had been running my whole life.
I felt this incredible shame.
I want my innocent back.
Now, I live in the city suburb of Borkum Hills, but I've never actually heard of the African Ladies Troupe. So can you tell me a bit more about my neighbours?
Yeah. No, yeah, you haven't heard about them. The doco itself actually doesn't explain the title, the Borkum Hills African Ladies Troupe, not as well as you would think it should. I didn't quite
like
get
mentioning
that.
Mentioning the suburb.
Yeah, but the stage production that this is, the documentary is effectively following the production of a stage show, and four African women who are all based in Sydney a part of this stage show. So over a three-year period, a theatre director called Roz Horan worked with these women and she developed this production around them expressing their life story up on stage. And she basically wanted wider audiences to understand migrant women's lives, particularly migrant women that had suffered enormously back in their home countries and then how they'd been able to survive through that and get to Australia. So the doco basically covers that three-year period, which went from initially meeting these four African women doing these different sessions around developing what the production would become, to the Borkum Hills African Ladies Troupe playing at the Sydney Opera House, playing at London. Like, it's done very well for itself, the production.
Wow. I mean, you've actually got me so thrilled I want to see the production, but what's the doco like?
Yeah, the doco is okay. It's not aiming for anything kind of fancy or revelatory. It's not a documentary that's trying to be whiz-bang. It's not reinventing any wheels. But it does document quite nicely the creation of this incredible production. I haven't actually seen the stage show, even though I know one of the women that's involved in it. So a lady called Rosemary, who I got to interview earlier this week, and that's coming up on the show very, very soon. So even though I knew Rosemary, I still hadn't been able to see the stage show. So it was nice to watch this documentary. And some of the things that get revealed in the documentary is the reason why you're turning up to watch this, I think, because those four women, Rosemary included, share some pretty incredible details about what happened to them, largely as children, particularly around sexual abuse and violence in their lives.
Okay, and so just to be clear, this is definitely not for the whole family.
No, it's not. Although it's presented fairly tamely, for want of a better expression. It's not one to gather the whole family around. And also, key details are left out of the documentary that I imagine are in the stage show. That seems to be a deliberate ploy, even though it gets a little bit frustrating when you're watching the documentary. Because if you haven't seen the stage show, there's some elements of it you would really like to know, such as, how did these women get to Australia?
So this is like an hour-long tease.
A little bit. It does have the feeling slightly of come watch our stage show. But more than that, it has a very serious intent, and one that I don't think is manipulative, which is, it's a statement about women joining together out of a sad, common experience to inspire, to encourage, and to help others who have gone through something similar. The documentary now has been showing at some cinemas around the place, but it's mainly available for people to either show in their community or in their church, or you know, get a town hall screening going on, so you can help your community better understand migrant women, particularly possibly where they've come from, what they've experienced, and then to encourage you into better relationships with migrant women in Australia. So if you go to africanladiestroop.com, you can find out how to access the documentary.
Yeah, right. Now, I understand that these women share the Christian faith, or some of them do.
They do.
Does that come across in this documentary?
Like it does, but it's fairly modest as well. I don't think it's been obscured deliberately. I don't think it's a ploy of those making the documentary that we're not going to show this, because it does bob up. But it's, I think it's the difference between someone trying to shape a documentary that was Christian based or wanting to promote a Christian message versus a documentary about women who happen to have Christian faith and that has helped them on their journey. A lady called Aminata, who's one of the African women, you see her leading some group prayers at different times, at kind of critical moments before they go on stage and asking for God's strength. And a woman called Yordi, she's very vocal about the anger and the wrestling that she's had with God in the past, in the midst of pain and suffering. So you get these punctuating moments, but unlike, say, one of the biggest releases at the moment at cinemas, Hacksaw Ridge, where you get, it's very clear and very strong about how central Christian faith is in someone's life, in the character of Desmond Doss in Hacksaw Ridge, African Ladies Troop, it more kind of permeates throughout. It would have been great to get a little bit more. As a Christian, I would love to have seen a little bit more about exactly how did the Holy Spirit work through their life and empower them and strengthen them, because that seems quite clear. And as we were about to hear in the interview with Rosemary, it was a definite like strength and gave her personally the strength to like persevere. The Holy Spirit did. It would have been excellent to have seen a bit more of that in the documentary. But saying all that, it is still incredibly powerful and inspiring. I think a lot of people will get into it if they can go to africanladiestroop.com and check it out.
Okay, well, the Baulkham Hills African Ladies Troop is rated M for mature themes. So you can book a screening at a cinema near you or purchase a copy of the documentary. If you want to do that, head to africanladiestroop.com.
That's right, africanladiestroop.com.
Fairly easy to remember, kind of like the big picture website.com.
.com.
There's a little cross promotion for you. Well, this moving documentary stars African ladies, including Rosemary Kariuki. Is that how I say that?
Kariuki, I believe, yes.
From Kenya. Speaking of which.
Yeah, well, for Press Record this week, we've got a real treat, an interview with Rosemary herself from the Baulkham Hills African Ladies Troop. Now, Ben, you're family friends with Rosemary.
Yeah, I am.
Yet, like the rest of her friends and family, you were amazed at what she revealed about her past.
Very much
through this
so.
Interview. So, Ben, you began by asking Rosemary, why did you decide to share such hidden personal details for the first time up on stage?
Rosemary, how did you come to decide to reveal such personal, painful information on stage when some of it you hadn't even shared with your family members before that?
I think it was just the timing, because this issue was always in back of my mind, and I kept on thinking of it, but I brushed it off. When the time came, Rose, the director, was sent to me by an organization called START. so that I can look for her some African women who'd want to tell their stories. So when I went to meet her, I said, from nowhere, I had not thought about it. I said, do you want to hear my story?
So you just decided on the spot, Rosemary?
It's as if subconsciously I knew I would one day I'll have to do it. It just came out, yes.
But without going into too much detail, because people can hear your story in the Borkum Hills African Ladies Troupe. They can watch the documentary. They can go see the stage production to hear more about it. But you revealed sexual abuse in your past within your family. How did your own family respond when they saw you revealing this up on stage?
My family haven't seen it because they're all the way in Kenya.
Mm.
But my family here, in my children, they were shocked because I've never told them. They said they didn't know how I manage it because I'm still laughing.
Mm.
And I still go on with life as if nothing has happened. So they were shocked, but they were so proud of me.
What about yourself, Rosemary? How proud are you that you're now a woman who's performed, you've performed at the Sydney Opera House with this, with this play. You've gone to London. You're now the star of a documentary. Did you ever imagine that this would ever happen to you?
No. That day when I went to tell the story, I didn't even know where it will, where, how it will start, how it will end. It just evolved itself up to even going to the big screens. I never ever thought of such a thing. So for me personally, and for the other four, three ladies, we are proud that if this can change one person, that is our prayer, that people out there, they can know rape is not okay. And if it has happened to you, you are not alone. There's a lot of help out there. Go and get help so that you can be able to live your life. Those people took your dignity, they took your confidence, but don't let them do that. There's help there. If you want to come and speak to one of us, we are ready to help you. That's the message we are taking out there.
You just mentioned there, Rosemary, that a big message from the from your documentary and from the stage show, that rape is not okay, and that women should seek all kinds of help in the healing process. But as you just mentioned a little bit earlier, you're also a woman who laughs a lot and smiles a lot and has got so much joy in life. How have you done that, Rosemary? What's kept you going?
One thing I think is because I know God. I'm a Christian. And I know God cannot give you shoes you cannot walk into. And when it is very hard, I always go back there and get the strength. I decided that I'll be happy because to shame the people who did this to me, I don't want them to win. As much as it's very hurting, it's bad, but it will not make me stop living. I want, when I smile, I give somebody else happiness.
Gentlemen, for the first time ever, that's right, the first time ever, the Eternals are happening.
The inaugural Eternals.
The inaugural Eternals, the Big Pictures Movie and TV Awards for 2016. Head to the website, thebigpicturewebsite.com, and vote now, and the winners will be announced on December 18. We've got a variety of categories that you can put your vote in for, including... In the past 12 months, what is your most favorite TV show? Now, Mark, as our resident TV guy here, have you got any suggestions?
I watch TV.
If you were going to vote, what would you be voting for this year?
Well, we've preloaded a stack of options for you for the best TV show of the year. And I personally went, oh, I'll put it on all my favorites. So Sherlock is there.
Of course, in number one build, yes.
Yes, no, the Flash.
No, actually, wow, how convenient.
11/22/63.
You're a big fan of that.
Brilliant Stephen King transaction. Of course, you've got The Get Down. Okay, Baz Luhrmann's there. There's a bunch of others. Maybe you're a Game of Thrones fan. Maybe you're a Daredevil fan. Maybe Making of a Murderer or A Place to Call Home. Go have a look at the website. Vote in your favorite one. And if we haven't got your favorite one there, put your favorite show in. There's a little other section there which you can fill to your heart's content with your favorite TV shows. Vote, because The Eternals is all about you saying what you think is worthy of a gong this year.
Mm-hmm. And the winners will be announced December 18 here on the show.
All right, coming up on The Big Picture, it's about to get a little bit weird. Dr. Strange is going to make a house call to The Big Picture and to you.
Welcome back, and especially to me.
Yes. It is good to have you back though, Mark.
It is. Well, let's face it.
No, it really is.
Okay, well, we've come up to our soundtrack segment. Look, are you hanging out for the next installment of Guardians of the Galaxy like me and pretty much the rest of the universe? Well, the trailer for Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was released this week, and the first film featured an awesome soundtrack based on Peter Quill, aka Star-Lord's, personal mixtape. So we thought we'd celebrate in our soundtrack segment this week with a highlight of Star-Lord's selection, courtesy of the Jackson 5. Popping around the kitchen? We were. Well, not the kitchen. Studio.
Studio.
Okay. Look, the Jackson's 5, I Want You Back, from the soundtrack of Guardians of the Galaxy. You might be interested to know the soundtrack album reached number one on the US Billboard 200 chart. Now, that doesn't sound like a big deal until you know that it was the first soundtrack album in history consisting entirely of previously released songs to actually top the chart. So it's kind of like
That's true. That's accurate.
Yeah, it's like we provided.
That's correct.
Yeah, we actually provided a mixtape to the world, and people went, "Yep, thanks. I like that."
Way to make money. Just get some songs together, sell it.
That's already been released. Yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 again makes a big deal of Star-Lord's mixtapes as part of the plot. So you can probably look forward to another chart-topping release when the film hits cinemas in May next year.
All right, well, earlier in the show, Mark brought us up to speed with The Flash, a DC Comics dude racing around.
There's just no end to these puns.
No, it's pun territory when it comes to speedy superheroes. But on the big screens, DC's archenemy Marvel Comics, who are clearly doing better, is back with its weirdest superhero yet. Doctor Strange takes us on a spectacular trip into another dimension, even if the destination remains the same.
Doctor Strange. You think you know how the world works? What if I told you the reality you know is one of many?
This doesn't make any sense.
Not everything does. Not everything has to.
Gentlemen, if you're not a comic book, I was going to say nerd, fan, nice. Like me, I don't tend to read comic books that much. I didn't really know anything about Doctor Strange before I went into the cinema to see Marvel's latest piece of work. Basically, what Doctor Strange is about is Dr. Stephen Strange, played by Sherlock's own Benedict Cumberbatch. He's an arrogant neurosurgeon. He has a car accident in the first couple of minutes. He loses ability in his hands and he seems like his life is over. Then he decides to go to Kathmandu in Nepal and to meet the Ancient One, who's played by Tilda Swinton, who's like some kind of spiritual superhero monk. Mm. And this spiritual superhero monk trains Doctor Strange in her order of cross-dimensional warriors who leap about the many universes which apparently are out there and we can tap into. Welcome to Doctor Strange.
Look, I am such a bigger comic book fan than you. Okay, it's pretty clear. And
welcome to Doctor Strange.
I'm so amped for this film. I haven't seen it yet. I've been holding back to see it with a mate. But we thought we'd send you along to Doctor Strange to preserve my happiness because you're a tougher man to please in the superhero department.
I am.
And you're thrilled.
I'm more thrilled than I have been with some other recent Marvel releases.
I'd just like to point out to the audience is thrilled.
So the one that sticks in my mind most of Marvel recently was that Avengers sequel, Age of Ultron, which I didn't think was that much chop, really. I thought that was a bit bloated, a bit slow, a bit repetitive, etc., etc. Doctor Strange, on the other hand, does what it says in the title, really quite weird, really quite different. It seems to mix up Caped Crusaders, Inception, and The Matrix all together in one movie. And you get this different kind of superhero. For example, there's a tense brain surgery sequence in the opening minutes. You get like brain action in terms of almost like an action sequence. That's how different I think Doctor Strange is. And then you get into all these other realms that pop up throughout Doctor Strange. It's almost like it's difficult to keep up with all the concepts and ideas going on in Doctor Strange. You get everything from inner power to enlightenment to selfishness and ego to levels of existence to ancient Greek philosophy and people fighting in their astral bodies.
So this is definitely out of the box for Marvel.
Well, I thought so. I mean, Marvel often dives into territory that's got higher concepts or tries to bring in different philosophies onto the screen. But this one brings it to the front and center, particularly when you're talking about the Ancient One, her followers, and Doctor Strange are frequently diving into everything from science versus the spiritual to the deep down cost of things. This is all front and center in Doctor Strange. It doesn't just sort of permeate in the background. It's up to the front. So as much as you get amazing visuals, it is quite a spectacle. Go see it in 3D. It will kind of blow your mind
That's what I was going to ask. Like, so this is definitely a 3D film?
Yeah, I thought so. Some of the Inception ripoff can get a bit old. That they really overuse, I think, some ideas from Inception that will just feel a little bit... That will feel a little bit creaky, a little bit tired to some viewers. But overall, yes, it's worth the kind of sensory overload that comes, mainly because this is such an idea, a film built on ideas rather than action set pieces. And that, I think, is very unusual and notable.
Okay, well, speaking of ideas, Marvel movies often sort of give us a universe without God in it. Mm-hmm. But Doctor Strange sounds like it's operating at least on a surreal or spiritual reality. Does that have any power behind it?
Yeah, to some degree. So this isn't a backflip on Marvel's creation of a universe without God. Most of their other movies, as we've noted on the show, if you go to bigpicturewebsite.com and check out any of the past Marvel movies that we've reviewed, we've often commented on the fact that God doesn't really seem to turn up in the universe. And that seems to be a deliberate thing.
Or
it's explained away. Sam mentioned to me that the director of Doctor Strange, Scott Derrickson, is actually a Christian, which is an interesting presence behind the screen in Doctor Strange. I don't think he's attempting to present a Christian worldview, but I find it fascinating. There's a lot of language and ideas which sound Christian. So you get everything from disciples to ancient books of wisdom, power and instruction, forbidden knowledge, false doctrine, zealots. Like, again, it's hard to keep up with all this sort of all these ideas that are coming through, particularly kind of on a Christian front. But Doctor Strange doesn't really mention God, there's a lot more here about spiritual power and realms and the reality of that.
So spirituality itself is dealt with as a real thing.
Yeah, but that's right. In a as much as Doctor Strange is a superhero comic book universe, it's dealt as much as you can deal with real things in that universe. It's dealt with quite seriously. And you get this Ancient One, Tilda Swinton's character, kind of talking about people becoming enlightened and they can play with and control other dimensions. So it sort of suggests that there's some construction and thinking behind the way that reality or unreality actually works. So there's some suggestion that there's actually an entity or power or something behind all these multiple universes that Doctor Strange is in, but what exactly that is difficult to tell.
Yeah, so with so much going on screen, like visually and also conceptually, did Doctor Strange take you to a place you hadn't been before?
Actually, the finale, without trying to give it away too much, I was really
Don't give it away.
I was really struck by it. I'm going to talk about it. I'm not going to tell you what happens, but I was struck by how it uses boredom as a weapon at the end of the film. Look out for that. I thought, so it did take me to a place that isn't very common in this kind of movies.
I'm trying not to think about it.
But Sam, it did. It took me to a place that we've definitely been to before, which is selfishness. I think I find selfishness often shows up in superhero movies. Often superheroes tend to be driven by just because I can, I will. And they've got a sense of justice or self-righteous justice or something internally is driving them. But Doctor Strange brings us to a point that a lot of other movies do, particularly in the character of Doctor Strange himself, which is ego and everything being about me. And then across the course of the film, which is a very strong theme going across this film, is someone realizing that to get to a new level of existence, to sort of change your life, to make it better, when it's only devoted to yourself, you're kind of holding yourself back. So if you want to change, if you want to move to this new dimension, you need to let yourself go, which echoes very strongly, gentlemen. I think Jesus promised that if we want to accept eternal life, which is a big thought and a big idea in Doctor Strange, if we want eternal life, we need to give up ourselves, follow him, give our life to him. That idea of letting go of yourself echoes throughout Doctor Strange. It just doesn't have the power or the weight or the promise that Jesus offers, even though eternal life and selfishness and ego all show up in Doctor Strange. So it'll get you thinking, definitely. It is a thinking person superhero movie.
And I'm thinking about seeing it very soon. Doctor Strange stars the Cumberbatch, his mum calls him Benedict, as well as Tilda Swinton, Mads Mikkelsen, and other people with names hard to pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
It's now showing and is rated M for fantasy themes and violence.
All right, coming up next on The Big Picture, the top five amazing pets and other fantastic beasts from the incredible zoo we like to call the movies.
Welcome back.
All right. Well, on next week's show, a little sneak preview, because we're going to be talking about fantastic beasts and where to find them, the latest creation to reach the big screen from the mind of Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling. So, to get us in the mood, the vault this week is dedicated to creature features. Ben spoke with Russ Matthews about some of cinema's most fantastic beasties.
One of the things we've forgotten is that there's been a lot of creature films that really set the tone or redefined a genre, as it were.
Redefined a genre? Give us some examples.
Example, if you remember 1985, Little Shop of Horrors, a creature feature being a musical.
I vaguely remember Little Shop of Horrors. And what's the creature? You're talking about that giant flower that's in that?
The big flower. It's Audrey 2, just so you know, it's not to be mistaken as Audrey 1, but it's Audrey 2. It plays the lead role, as it were, and is the creature, the one that terrifies and actually causes Rick Moranis to say, "Feed me."
A giant person-eating plant in Little Shop of Horrors. What else you got for us?
Okay, well, another one would be, it's more of a cult classic that maybe not too many people know about, but just the name alone of the creature is worth having. It'd be the Graboid. The Graboid from Tremors, 1990. These huge worms that are going through the earth and terrifying this small town, I believe it's in the outer part of Texas, and going through, and it will take not only people, but cars underground with them.
This is a good start for a creature feature list. Hit us with some more.
Okay, now a couple classics, though, that I think that really did redefine is, like, one would be the sci-fi horror, and that would be Alien, 1979's Alien, Ridley Scott, with the xenomorph that he had. Xenomorph, it would be the alien that was almost unstoppable.
Oh, the name of that creature in the Alien film is called Xenomorph? I'm with you so far on this journey, and you're right, that movie did redefine science fiction and horror. Any other genre-defining creatures you can list off?
Well, I'd say that the T-Rex and Jurassic Park still, I mean, is one of those things that even you can still see it, you know, these objects may seem a little bit larger, you know, you can see it when T-Rex is chasing after the people. It still terrifies people, but yet is one of the most entertaining films of all time.
Yeah, it's amazing that David Spielberg was able to concoct family thrills out of dinosaurs and how long-lasting that franchise has been. Anything else?
Yeah. Well, actually, going to the whole idea of family films, it's hard to think of a creature feature being a family film, but Monsters, Inc., Pixar really took something that was, for most children, one of the most terrifying things, of considering having a monster under your bed or a monster in your closet, but actually make it cute and cuddly. You have Sully and you have Mike Wazowski, of all things that even kids are able to say, Mike Wazowski. Monsters, Inc. really redefined the creature feature for a family family film.
And they were able to sell toys off the back of it as well, Russ.
Well, last one I'd say, if you want to go back to Thriller from Michael Jackson.
What movie link is there between Michael Jackson's hit song Thriller and Creature Features? Discuss.
It's amazing link. The link is John Landis. And John Landis actually had a film called An American Werewolf in London, another cult classic, but it actually won an Academy Award for Best Makeup. And that is why Michael Jackson ended up hiring John Landis to do his Thriller video.
So we're not trying to suggest that Michael Jackson was a creature feature, but that's a very good link. That's a very good link between Creature Features and Michael Jackson. So, for anyone who's been inspired by Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, you've just given us a great creature feature list to go back through the vault of cinema history and check some more out.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ben, for having me along.
Like so many different people on our show or listen to the show, you fancy yourself a bit of a movie critic? Well, we do. And if you want to have a go...
We do.
If you want to have a go at basically saying what you think deserves a gong this year, head over to thebigpicturewebsite.com, thebigpicturewebsite.com, for The Eternals. Okay, announced on December 18th. For the first time ever, you'll be telling us what you think deserves to be awarded this year.
So you can go and vote now for all kinds of different categories, including...
You can do most favourite film for the past 12 months. Was it Batman v Superman for you?
That would be yours, wouldn't it? Ben Affleck's in that.
Oh, please kill me now. Well, how about The Magnificent Seven?
No, not so much. I reckon I might be voting for more something like Spotlight or maybe Room. If when you see Doctor Strange, that may rise to the top of your list, possibly.
No,
Batman versus Superman.
No, slightly below Star Trek Beyond, I think. But look, if anybody wants to have a go at telling us what you think is the best film of the year, head over to thebigpicturewebsite.com. You've only got a few weeks left before we start tallying the votes and have our super award show at the end of the year.
All right, it is the segment I've been waiting all week for, the top five.
You're such a massive fan of the top five, Sam. Why so?
Because I love a countdown. Who doesn't love a countdown?
That's it. That's all you need is a countdown.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're going to have one of the Eternals, so I'm looking forward to that as well. But
there you go.
Ben, you got this week's top five
for us. Yeah, we were just talking about Creature Features and Fantastic Beasts. That new J.K. Rowling product is going to be at cinemas real soon. Got us thinking about that kind of realm of cinema history, and so I bring to you the top five amazing pets.
Five.
2010's Toothless the Dragon from How to Train Your Dragon, as in the film was out in 2010. He wasn't 2010 years old. Toothless the Dragon, quite a young dragon.
I love Toothless.
I thought you might be a fan of Toothless. Better than Pete's Dragon, I reckon.
Heck yeah.
Possibly better than the Luck Dragon from Neverending Story, although that's contentious.
You're kidding me.
But I figure I seem to mention Neverending Story about every second week, so I thought I'd better not mention it again now. Instead, point to Toothless the Tiger. Sorry, Toothless the Tiger. Toothless the Dragon.
You walked out of your wedding to the Neverending Story.
That may or may not be true. Hiccup, the boy Viking, is kind to Toothless in How to Train Your Dragon, helps him overcome a quote-unquote disability so that Toothless can help Hiccup himself overcome his apparent lack of ability. That is a great pet. Plus, it's a dragon. Plus, it's a fire-breathing, flying dragon. And that is cool.
Four.
Now, something a little bit creepy, a little bit sinister. I'm using the term amazing fairly loosely here. Because if amazing happens to mean this will terrify your children, then that is what I mean with my fourth choice, Pet Sematary from 1989, that Stephen King novel. As soon as most parents would hear about Stephen King, they'll probably run for the hills because they're right. Most of the stuff that he puts out is horror. This shouldn't be confused with Secret Life of Pets, gentlemen, that was released this year. No,
If you thought Pet Sematary was for the whole family. Gather round. Please sit down and watch Pet Sematary.
Oh, no.
Do not gather round. Not one for the whole family. This is Stephen King's Spookfest about dead pets resurrecting. There is a cat named Church in this movie who comes back from the dead. I'm not sure if that's a comment about the institution with the same name as Church. I don't know if Stephen King is going for something deeper in meaning. I don't know. All I know about Pet Sematary is a cat dies, comes back to life again. And initially, the kids in the house, I think, are pretty thrilled about that. Like, great, the cat's returned, looking a little bit, like, oily and greasy and having really crazy eyes. And then it's a Stephen King book, so it kind of goes a little bit dark after that.
We had a pet that resurrected.
What?
Yeah, seriously. We had this goldfish who died. And I dealt with it as every parent does eventually. I put it in the toilet. And the kids came in and went, the fish is back.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it is. A little bit like Cat the Church from Pet Sematary.
Three.
Just kept on coming back.
And here's the bit where I cheat on this list. Where I said it was going to be from cinema history, but I couldn't just limit it to cinema. I had to go to TV because how could you do a list, a top five list of amazing pets without mentioning Skippy? 1968 to 1970, the classic Australian TV show, Skippy the Bush Kangaroo. Come on, like, are you not a fan of Skippy? How could you just chortle along? Surely at the mention of the name Skippy, it resurrects fantastic memories.
I'm too young.
Sam?
What?
Yeah, Skippy didn't.
No, I think you're just un-Australian, Sam.
Yeah,
how can you be like that? There were 91 shows
you
of
don't
Skippy.
Love your country.
I can't believe this, Sam. And even
I know that Skippy flies a helicopter.
He did a lot of things, and Mark's just doing the noise then. That's what I would have expected when you say Skippy, someone to try to do the noise. You remember things like Skippy doing everything from helping people get out of wells to... What's that skip? To flying helicopters, to I think he could probably blow on gum leaves. And he had those famous scenes of like his paw reaching in and doing things, but that was like
into his pouch.
Into his pouch.
His pouch. About that, people who understand anything about the anatomy of kangaroos.
So sure, there may have been some limitations when it came to how truthful Skippy was.
Did you know how they did the kangaroo
paw?
Hands?
It was basically a paw and a stick.
They were decapitated paws.
Okay, sure. We're sort of tearing down the memory of Skippy here, people. But I weep for the education of this country, gentlemen, when I hear that Sam Robinson doesn't even really register when the name Skippy turns up. What should happen, I think, is school children should be made to watch Skippy in classrooms to understand. When you were at school,
Sam. Yeah, what happened to your education? You didn't even know there were decapitated paws.
I was too busy watching Power Rangers.
Skippy, it was huge in my own childhood. And a big shout out to Ku-ring-gai Chase National Park in the northern suburbs of Sydney, because that's where Skippy was filmed.
Two.
Now, here's a little bit of a hybrid, blokes, between movies and TV, just because I couldn't quite leave the TV realm alone. Lassie. Lassie, number two on the amazing pets list. Because,
the collie.
Because, come on, how can you think about an amazing pet without the name Lassie somehow surfacing to your mind? We've had a lot of dog heroes on screen, everyone from Rin Tin Tin to Benji and that dog on Frasier. But really, female collie Lassie... is like, come on, this top dog. Like, she spent 3 decades on the big and small screen. 3 decades doing all kinds of amazing dog stuff that really Skippy went on to just rip off. Like, Skippy was just watching reruns of Lassie and thought, I could do that. And I'm going to take it to the next level. I'm going to drive
a
helicopter.
Dog, for Pete's sake.
I don't think Lassie ever drove a helicopter, but Lassie could always find its way home. Even if you...
Across America.
Across America. You could plonk Lassie, I think, like,
or
starting
was that
point.
Benji?
Lassie definitely did it. The first film, Lassie Come Home, I think would indicate that in the title. And then pretty much summarizes the rest of Lassie's career.
Lassie Come Home 2.
That basically the storyline of every Lassie movie seemed to be Lassie gets lost, Lassie has to come home. Or some kids get lost, Lassie has to rescue them and come home. Even if those kids are in the USSR, say.
If they remake Lassie today, will Lassie have a GPS?
No, Lassie didn't need that because as the Courage of Lassie title for the movie would suggest, Lassie has courage, not doesn't need GPS. What Lassie did have was its own pet food line and a TV show about pet care.
Oh,
of course.
One.
But number one on the amazing pets list can't be Skippy, can't be Lassie, can't even be Toothless the Dragon. No, it had to be Gizmo the Mogwai from Gremlins in 1984. Mm. Gizmo the Mogwai. Sam, you've seen this movie?
Oh, I watched it the other night.
You did? What?
It was on TV, yeah.
Was it? I tend to show up when Christmas time comes around. It's one of those
for some reason.
Strangely
it was for Halloween,
dark...
actually.
For Halloween?
Yeah.
Oh, it doubles nicely for Halloween and for Christmas time of year. It's for anyone who hasn't seen the movie, it's very difficult to describe a Mogwai apart from saying they're cute and tiny, a little bit like a really, really small teddy bear troll doll, yet not as ugly. It's a super good looking piece of work.
Have we actually mentioned it's from the film Gremlins?
We have mentioned it's from the film Gremlins in 1984. Yeah, you can carry it around in your backpack. Girls, I think, would love it if you were walking around the streets. Boys, if you just take note, if you want to oppress a young lady, go and find a Mogwai and walk around with that. Gizmo the Mogwai is pretty cool. And it also drove a Barbie car around. A Barbie car, your pet that can drive a Barbie car around the house. The downside, as we're about to hear in a clip we're about to play, is that well, if you don't follow the rules with a Mogwai, it can actually turn into a Gremlin. So I think Gremlins is a good lesson for kids and for adults out there about following instructions, following rules, because your cute and cuddly Mogwai, which is number one on the amazing pets list, might actually go bad.
Right,
no.
Right, What happened?
He hates bright lights. You know, there's some things I forgot to tell you guys, and they're really important. Number one, he hates bright lights. We know that. But you got to keep him out of the sunlight. Sunlight will kill him. Number two, keep him away from water. Don't give him any water to drink. And whatever you do, don't give him a bath. And probably the most important thing, don't ever feed him after midnight.
That was the excuse my parents actually gave me for never actually feeding me after six.
That you will turn into a gremlin?
Something could go terribly wrong. We're not really sure. There's science in these films. You can't disregard them.
And then 1994's Gremlin showed up. And finally, they went, see? See? I told you.
See, that's why your little sister is the way she is.
But I've never confused you for a Mogwai either.
Thank you. I have less hair.
All right. Well, coming up on The Big Picture next week, you can find Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them right here.
They will be discovered right here. And Moving Back Home isn't a failure, it turns out. It's actually funny in ABC TV's Rosehaven.
And one of the year's biggest sci-fi movies eventually turns up. It arrives, well, its arrival.
Mm-hmm. I will still be Ben McKechnie next week.
And I'll be Mark Hadley. Looking forward to seeing you then.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.